The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So the question is, why does it seem so difficult to reach enlightenment? And so I'm going to paraphrase the question a little bit. The direction towards Nibbana, towards entering the stream and reaching Nibbana. And the basic question is, how can I have small signs to confirm that I'm practicing the Dhamma correctly? I think this is an important question, and I think kind of coupling it with the question about the goal of the practice to reach Nibbana, I think it is important to practice that the practice that we do does have a direction. It's aimed in a direction. But it's important to know what it is. I mean, the word enlightenment, I think, enlightenment's not actually a very good translation of Nibbana, in my view. The word Nibbana in Pali has a connotation of, literally, I think the word means cooling. Some teachers have said, and I don't know Pali that well, but some teachers have said that the word Nibbana is used more in conventional ways in the Pali language, or would have been used in more conventional ways in the Pali language. That, you know, if the rice is sitting on the table and it's waiting a long time before being eaten, that it is Nibbana-ing, it is cooling. So that it's just the release. It's the release of the heat. And that really kind of speaks to what the practice is. It is the release from the heat or the fire of greed, aversion, and delusion. And the Buddha did use the analogy for fire for these reactive mind states. These states of mind that create suffering. And when we feel them with mindfulness, when we attune to the experience of frustration or confusion or desire or hatred or rage or even irritation or annoyance, we feel a kind of attention to the body and mind that can have a quality of almost burning. And so the Nibbana, the definition, the simplest definition for Nibbana in the suttas is the absence of greed, the absence of aversion, the absence of delusion. So this is the aim of the practice, to release the mind from greed, aversion, and delusion. And the path of practice kind of mirrors that, or the path reflects the goal, that we can kind of know or have a sense that we're practicing the Dharma in alignment with this direction. When we begin to, first of all, begin to understand what the experience of greed, aversion, and delusion is, and understand that it is fire, that it is tension, that it is not release and ease and peace. And so through the practice of mindfulness, we start to get a sense of the difference between the mind caught in these reactive states and the mind not caught in these reactive states. When greed, aversion, and delusion are present and we are mindful of them, we feel the way they burn. We feel the way they create tightness and tension and constriction in our hearts. When we experience compassion and kindness and love, or where we feel the release from, you know, we can sometimes in our practice feel how something lets go, how a constricted mind state releases. And in that experience of feeling that release, we know the difference. We know the quality of mind, the difference in the quality of mind between the mind that's caught in these constricted, reactive states and the quality of the mind that is letting go of them. And there's no question in that mind, when the mind feels that letting go or feels that release, understands that difference in the moment, there's no question in the mind that that is the direction for the path. So those kinds of experiences help us to confirm that we're practicing the Dhamma in a way that leads to the end of suffering, a way that leads towards that aim of the ending of greed, the absence of greed, the absence of aversion, the absence of delusion. And yet this is a process, I would say. You know, the Buddha used a number of analogies for the path of practice, and he called it a gradual path. But one analogy that he used that particularly resonates with me, he talked about the unfolding of the practice being like the way the rigging of a ship that has been pulled up on dry land, the way that rigging will dry out and rot and fray over the course of months. You know, after a shipwreck, if you've got the parts of the ship that are strewn on the beach, over the course of the months, the sun, the sand, the water, the waves, the wind will like wear away at that rope, at the rigging, the ship's rigging. Gradually, imperceptibly, day by day, if you went each day to that beach and looked at that rope, you would not see the difference day to day. But inexorably, it is wearing away at the rope. And he said, the sun, the sand, the wind, the waves are like the mindfulness, like the effort that we make. And so this is a gradual path. It is. We don't necessarily see or know day to day what is being released, what is changing. Like, you can't tell with that rope what has frayed away. And so sometimes there has to be some trust. And some of that trust, the trust that I am on the path, and there have been many. Part of the reason this particular analogy really resonates for me is because so much of my practice has been gradual. So much of the learning, the understanding, the freedom that comes is like imperceptible. The way some things have fallen away, like one pattern of anger, you know, it was a long process of working with it, just meeting it, you know, each day, seeing it, feeling the suffering of it. And this is a part of how we can know we're on the path too, is that when we feel the suffering, when we know, yes, this is what's arising, this is anger that's arising, and the feeling of this is suffering, that's a different thing than just being angry. So that's another kind of distinction, the distinction that our minds and a way we can know we're on the path, that when we know the difference between being lost or being in a state such as anger, so being angry or being frustrated or being confused, versus being aware that anger is arising as an experience in the present moment. There's a vast difference between those two. And we can begin to have a sense of that difference when mindfulness kind of holds, or there's a container in of mindfulness in which these states are arising, and we can know that, oh yeah, this is what's arising. This is the experience that's arising right now. We begin to taste the, maybe even in that moment, the little subtle difference between being caught and knowing that something is there, knowing that a state of reactivity is present. And in that difference, well, the first thing, at least in my experience, the first thing that I noticed in that difference is that I became aware of the suffering of that state. I became aware that it was painful. But over time, I also became aware that it was less suffering to be aware that it was suffering than to be caught in it and reinforcing it. And so this, we begin to get through the practice of mindfulness, we begin to know these differences, this kind of distinction between wholesome and unwholesome, the distinction between being aware of reactivity and just being reactive. There's a wholesome state of mind there when we can be aware of being reactive, and that's wisdom and mindfulness are at work there. They're knowing that experience. And so we begin to get the taste of that, and there is a trust that begins to develop that even if that state, I mean, I think sometimes we think we need like more obvious evidence than just this gradual wearing away of something. You know, the gradual wearing away metaphor kind of means in some ways that, yeah, we get to see our reactive patterns over and over and over again. It does. It's not just that we see them and they go poof, you know, that like a little bit of mindfulness and they're like falling apart. But often we, in terms of our, you know, wanting confirmation that we're on the path, that's what we're looking for. You know, we want something like obvious, like, you know, oh, that thing is going away. But there are subtler kind of things that will help us to know we're on the path, such as, yes, I can be aware of this and know that it's suffering. I can be aware of anger while it's happening and know that it's suffering. If you can be aware of a reactive state and know that it's suffering, even if it's not getting weaker, as long as it's not getting stronger, as not long as it doesn't feel like you're being pulled into the rabbit hole of it, as long as it doesn't feel like it's taking you over, as long as you can stay mindful of it, there is some wisdom developing there. And so that's a place of trust. Now, it doesn't necessarily feel like what we think it should feel like when we're on the path. But for myself at least, you know, I've gotten enough confidence in that place that there's a kind of subtle feeling of, yep, I'm able to see this, so it's okay. You know, so there's kind of an attitude of mind that knows it's okay that this is there. So that's another kind of thing to be attuned to is how is the mind in relationship to experience? But I'm going to talk about that in a moment. I want to go back to this gradual unfolding, the weakening of things. You know, I worked with this pattern, like I mentioned earlier, I worked with this pattern of anger for a very long time, and it didn't feel like it was changing much. And in fact, you know, I didn't have the capacity to really meet it with mindfulness. In fact, I had to put it aside. I saw it arising, and I could feel myself getting sucked into it. So I said, yeah, I see you, and I'm going to like put my attention somewhere else. I did that a lot for a very long time, months, many months, maybe even a couple of years. I don't remember how long this happened, this was going on, but it kept coming up. And I just would keep seeing that the power of that anger was so explosive. It came up so quickly that that the mindfulness wasn't strong enough for it. It was just going to suck me into it. So I set it aside. I attended to something else. And I did that over and over again. The setting aside was done with kind of compassion and kindness. It was not done with aversion. It was not done with any sense of, I can't stand this. It was more of a sense of compassion for my mind that, yeah, this is hard. And, you know, it doesn't seem to make sense to try to be mindful of this right now. So I'm going to put my attention somewhere else. But the gradual nature of the way this unfolded in my practice was that over time, I kind of started noticing at some point that the pattern didn't come up as frequently. This was anger at a particular person about a particular thing. So this was a very specific kind of anger. This is not anger in general. This was a specific anger. And I began noticing that it came up less and it wasn't as strong. Like it was more, would pop in and then go out. So it wasn't as strong, but it still arose. And I still kept saying, okay, I'll just, you know, put my attention elsewhere. And then one day I kind of realized out of the blue that I hadn't felt that anger in a very long time. That particular anger had not arisen in a very long time. So this is another piece of faith and trust in the practice, of the confidence in the practice, is we can start to notice the non-arising of greed, aversion, and delusion, even in very limited ways. And in this case, it was the non-arising of this anger that I noticed. It hasn't been arising. It hasn't been coming up for quite a long time. And in that reflection, it's kind of like the person that I was angry with and the situation came up into my mind, but I could not find the anger. It was gone. And so somehow over the course of those months or many months of my just meeting it and turning my attention to something else, it had worn away. And I understand it kind of through the non-engagement with the pattern. You know, I didn't try to repress the pattern, but I also didn't engage with the pattern. I didn't, like, you know, go in there and say, yeah, I'm really angry at that person and they deserve my anger. I didn't feed the anger, but nor did I try to be with it particularly. I just turned my attention to something else. So that process over the course of months somehow allowed the wearing away of it, like the wearing away of the rope. And I didn't see it going away. You know, it disappeared when I wasn't looking. But there was a sense of kind of, you know, the confidence of knowing that it's there and knowing that stepping aside from it was a compassionate thing to do, that not trying to force myself to be with it when that just took me into it, that was a compassionate thing to do. And so that too is kind of, you know, these qualities, that the qualities that we begin to get familiar with that help us, that are maybe little signposts on the path. You know, the recognition of suffering as suffering, and then the qualities of compassion and connection to experience and understanding and wisdom and the mindfulness itself, we begin to see those as leading, as onward leading. We begin to see them as supporting us. And we begin to trust that. So it doesn't always feel in any particular moment like you can say, you know, like you can, like you don't always get the kind of confirmation you might want about being on the path in every single moment. But there is a way that our kind of trust and faith in the the practice of mindfulness. And for me, that trust and faith got strong through the experiences of seeing the value of it. It wasn't just abstract faith. It's like the confidence grew in the practice as the mind started to see and feel those little moments of release. A moment of seeing anger let go, or anger not arise, or you know, just many, many, many different little like experiences that we can have of noticing, oh, that's just frustration arising, and kind of feeling a little space around it, feeling a sense of, yeah, it's okay that that's there. It's being seen. And we feel that that confidence grow in the capacity of our minds to meet experience. And that becomes that just even the sense of, oh, this is what it's like for the mind to meet dukkha. Even if the dukkha doesn't go away, you know, the confidence that that it's valuable for the mind to meet that experience, that becomes our kind of confidence that we're on the path, that we're practicing correctly, that we're practicing in a way that leads us to freedom. So, you know, basically the one of the key distinctions is defined by the aim. It's like the aim, or the nibbana, is the absence of greed, aversion, and delusion. And so little experiences that kind of allow us to feel the absence of greed, aversion, and delusion, feel even like little headings in that way, releases from like small moments of release from frustration or anger or pride or arrogance or confusion, little moments of that release. Even those give us the taste of the other side of the absence of greed, aversion, and delusion. Just little tastes of it. And that develops our confidence in the doing of the practice. So another piece that I just wanted to bring in, wow, we may not have too much time for questions. But I do want to say this piece, that while we're aware of our experience, one of my teachers, Saito Utejaniya, often says awareness alone is not enough, because, you know, we can be aware that we're angry and be angry at the same time. A thief going through a house to steal things can be very aware of what they're doing, but the motivation behind that is greed, is unethical, is stealing. And so we can be aware of what's happening in the present moment and have a kind of an intention in our mind that is not aimed towards curiosity about what is this experience as a human experience. That thief in the house is not curious about, well, what does it feel like to be stepping? What does it feel like to be reaching and touching? They're aware of being quiet in their movements so that they're not making noise, that they're going to be caught. This is a very different motivation for awareness. And so the motivation for awareness, or what's in the mind that is aware, the attitude of mind, it's useful to be attuned to that. That as you're noticing what's happening in your experience, you know, even being aware of, I've seen this a lot in my practice, being aware of unpleasant physical sensation. I spent a lot of time in meditation retreat being aware of unpleasant physical sensation in order that it would go away. And that was, you know, in a way, reinforcing aversion. So the attitude of mind, it's important to at least know what the attitude of mind is. If we're unaware that we're observing experience in order to make it go away, then we are cultivating aversion. But if we are aware that, wow, this experience is happening and I don't like it, I'd like it to go away. If we're aware of that, oh, that's what's happening. There's unpleasantness and I want it to go away. That's what's happening. Then that's a different kind of attitude. Maybe we can be okay that we want it to go away. Oh, that's what's going on. And we may feel, as we kind of step into knowing what the attitude of the mind is, we may step into a feeling of, oh, it's okay that that is happening. So the attitude of mind can be one of greed, aversion, or confusion. You know, we might be attending to experience with a wish to get something or a wish to get rid of something or confused about it. But we also might be attending to it with this kind of, well, it's okay. So with an attitude that is holding it, with the kind of the curiosity and okayness that this is what's here. That okayness may be felt in many different ways. It might be felt like compassion or connection or curiosity or friendliness or even just simple, you know, yeah, it's not a problem that this is what's here. And when we can know that, if we're experiencing that kind of an okayness, sometimes this is another piece that helps us begin to viscerally touch into this is the path, because the quality of the mind that is okay, there's an ease there. You know, the mind that's not constricted or fighting what's happening, there's an ease in that mind. And that mind, the feeling of that, when we can touch into it, we can actually be experiencing a reactive state and have this quality of, you know, even delight or joy. I've sometimes felt it's like, wow, that is so amazing that that is still happening. Look at that. And so there can be a kind of a curiosity, a delight, a joy in the seeing of it. And that helps us also to know this is the path. And we know it's the path partly because the feeling of those qualities of mind, the feeling of curiosity, the feeling of joy, delight, of compassion, of love, of friendliness, the heart feels more at ease with that. There's a softening, a softness in the heart, a softness and a kind of a non-tension around the experience. And yet it is a gradual process to get to the place where we do experience like reactive states arising and have the simultaneous experience of ease with it. It's a gradual development of that. And yet it doesn't actually take that long for us to begin to get a sense of these differences, the differences between what it's like for a mind to be caught and not caught. And that distinction is really the place where we begin to know we're on the path, we're practicing in a good way, in a helpful way. And we fall off that path all the time. You know, it's like if you find yourself off the path, you know, as soon as you notice that, there's the possibility of, oh, I've been lost and the mind has been all confused and I'm aware of that now. So, you know, it's like in a recent retreat, we were talking about this analogy of the path and how it feels like we've really wandered. Maybe we've wandered for like a long time off the path, like getting involved in our stories and our reactivity. But as soon as we notice that we've been off the path, in that moment, instantly we can be on the path again. Oh, that's what's happening. The mind is caught by that story. That's what's happening. And so it's not like we have to like weed whack our way back to find the path. It's instantly available. There it is. Oh, awareness of this. So I did take the entire time with that question. So we won't have time for questions tonight. I'm sorry about that.